The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
AI is changing the world as we know it, and it's doing it at a pace that's completely unprecedented. Never before have we had the ability to analyze a picture, extract findings from a PhD thesis, or even write a report literally at the click of a button. Yet is it leading to better outcomes? Is AI's lightning speed helping us understand the world more deeply, make better decisions, or even write better reports? To unravel this complex web, I've brought an expert from a company that are global leaders in optimizing how people and machines can work together. Jan Brohilke, Managing Partner Assurance, EY Germany. Welcome to The Optimist.
Thank you, Dale. Good to be here.
And look, you know, I do so many of these interviews with people who are working in different facets of technology. And actually, I like to start by getting to know a bit about them personally, what makes them tick, because I think if you're working at any field at this level, you know, you have to have a way to approach your world so that you can keep performing at the top of your game. And what's your way of doing that? How do you start your day? How do you go through your daily pattern?
Well, I start my day at least 6 of 7 days a week with sports. So I do sports 6 days a week every morning. So I usually get up at 6. I switch between running, swimming, some weightlifting, sometimes cycling, depends on where I am, which hotel, what facilities are possible. And after that, you know, the normal chaos starts. So either at home with my 3 kids or somewhere in a hotel or in a conference room, wherever I am. And let's say my usual day start is that I've forgotten everything overnight. So I usually wake up very optimistic, independently how hard the last day was. So being in a podcast about optimism is pretty nice.
And look, you've said a couple of really key words. Of course, the optimist, you're at the Optimist podcast. Starting the day with optimism, I think that's a really nice, you know, impulse for the discussion. And I hopefully where we'll be also going today with our talking, because, you know, if you look at the world around us now, there's always more complexity. Mm. I feel like the number of routes that we can take, even in a morning, it's not got more simple, it's got more complex. How do you deal with that? And I guess to bring the word in already, has AI made things worse?
No. So, well, maybe I'm a bit naive and not bright enough, but I don't think that the day has been more difficult or complex than 20 years ago when I started. Even my position in the last 20 years has changed, of course. But at the end of the day, we can only do the best we can every day. And AI is, from my point of view, a technology like a new technology that has been new 50, 60, 70 years ago, whatever. If you take the World Wide Web, when it has been introduced, it has been new as well, right? And everyone adopted. And I personally used AI very much over the last weekend. And I was impressed what AI can do. And I think we will probably talk about later about what it means to my profession and what it means to other companies. But I think it is a massive opportunity for all of us, as long as we understand what we can do and what we can't.
Mm. You know, I want you to spill the beans now. Mm-hmm. Share with the listeners what we, on the weekend, I mean, it's your weekend, what were you doing with AI?
Well, a very personal thing. My wife and I think about buying a new house, right? And I just loaded the floor plan to ChatGPT and I said, look, I want to change the floor plan to the following. So my asks are how many rooms I want to have, blah, 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 blah. But I want to be as efficient cost-wise as possible because it's our second home. And it took, let's say, 2 or 3 interactions with ChatGPT and I got a pretty nice floor plan. And then I said, okay, do you think I can change these kind of walls? Right. And of course, it says, yes, there's a disclaimer. We don't know, blah, blah, blah. But the work that ChatGPT has performed, which literally be done 5 years ago by an architect, and it would have cost probably 2 weeks of work. And now I can go to an architect and say, I want to have it like this, right? So, and this brought to me, first of all, it was good because, right, in a personal sense, you use it and you can elaborate with your wife and build plans. And it was so quick and so easy. So that was very impressive. It's a simple question for AI, right? So it's nothing spectacular, but it has changed in a very simple way, the way how we approach this project now.
Yeah. Do you know, it's fascinating. It is these little things, though, that really make a small difference in your day, you know? And I think, you know, I've started really playing around with agents as well now, you know, working with Claude's agents. I've just become a new addicted Landoc user, so I'm building workflows in Landoc that analyze all my emails. So I see, you know, a ping comes up if I get an important email that I've not answered for a day. They're only little things, but they take you away from... You know, and that's, I guess, the provocative question that I had before, is it making life more complex? In many situations, it's making it easier.
Yes. Well, look, my father has had the same profession than I have, right? So he was also a German CPA. And he once told me that when he was in my position, let's say 40 years ago, you deliver as a CPA, you deliver an audit opinion at some point of time. So when he delivered it, it was sent by post, not by email, right? Because there was no email. Then the client read through the report and corrected some things. So he sent it back by post. And this back and forth took 14 days because delivery in Germany was 3 or 4 days and it took some days through the post office, blah, blah, blah. So today it's 2 or 3 hours, right? So it also brings us to a different speed and we have to cope with it as humans. Because it also could, at least with some persons, rise the stress level. So you need to learn and you need to also change your way how you cope with it. Because if you get stressed by getting an email very quickly as in return, you are probably stressed by AI as well, right? So you need to find mechanism how you can cope with it. But what I always say, you cannot close your eyes anyway, right? Because it's coming. And either, as you say, you use it for your life or you're getting lost at the end of the day.
Yeah. You know, I guess that speed of reply and the expectation, I guess that might be something that is also, there's been this saying, I feel like it's been since the 90s, people have been saying, you know, change has never been accelerating faster, which is kind of this extreme saying, but I really feel it now, you know, in terms of, you know, the difference between people who do use AI effectively and how effective they are in their work versus those who don't. Do you see that in your clients?
Yeah, of course. And I think it was last September, I was in a preparation meeting with a supervisory board chairman, also the owner of a pretty large business in Germany. And we had a good conversation. We know each other, I don't know, 15 years. And so we talked about the coming audit and what he would love us to audit as well and so on and so forth. And after a 1 hour meeting, he said, you know what? All the questions I ask you, I just asked 30 minutes ago, ChatGPT. And you couldn't recognize it. The questions were perfect. So I thought, well, he was well prepared, and he was. And so that was my first real eye-opener when I thought, wow, such an, let's say, old man. He just used it and it was so good.
It's fascinating. Actually, you know, I'm going to make myself very vulnerable here in this podcast by admitting to this, but, you know, I supervise at the University of Amsterdam's School of Business, and the volume of stuff that I have to deal with from the students, I have to pre-vet that with AI to understand where they're coming from. And, you know, and then I think of the irony of that, or the kind of, you know, it's almost kind of a double standard, is if they're caught using AI, then they're in all sorts of trouble. But then I wonder, because, you know, the answers that I get, or the proposal I get in the master's thesis from my students, some of them are breathtakingly brilliant, completely impractical, because you could never pull it off in a master's thesis. But they're brilliant. And then it makes you sort of wonder, at what point, even with your clients, is it just AI talking to AI? You know, is it my very good models talking to your very good models? And where's the human?
I think at some point of time, yes, we are moving to that. And what you just described is when we go into big audit pitches, It's a very long process. It takes over a year sometimes. And what we expect now, because now it's a second wave of mandatory farm rotation coming on in Germany, we expect that 10 years ago, all these written proposals were read by humans. We think now they send it through an AI and say, okay, did they tick the box we asked for? And when they tick, they are gone to box A saying, great. And if they haven't ticked every box, it's going to B, so you're out. And now the answer to your question. After that, there's usually a human contact. So you have a pitch, you have a pitch situation, because at the end of the day, it's human who trusts humans. And yes, AI will talk to AI. At the moment, shared service centers are talking to shared service centers, by the way. So it's in a lot of situations, our clients have shared service centers in Poland or India or wherever. And we do have them as well. So sometimes our Indian colleagues speak to Indian shared service centers as well. And let's say in 5, 6, 7 years, it will be AI to AI. But if you stand in front of a supervisory board and the supervisory board members, all humans, are legally responsible, they will ask Mr. Broeker, are you sure?
Yeah.
And you have to answer, yes, I am, as Jan Broeker, sure.
Mm. And this is the thing, you can't submit a report of 50 pages and have not read that report. And, you know, I bet you, because you're an expert, that when you read the reports from AI, you come up with major holes and they have to be fixed by a human.
Well, AI will become better, but and I think that was something you were talking about at the beginning, we will see more, for example, the numbers and reports and sources with AI than 20 years ago, having a human who tried to audit everything alone, right? So the questions we can ask will become better. So the level of assurance will rise with AI. It doesn't mean that it will be more efficient, because you see more details. You will ask more questions. But the outcome in terms of quality will rise, which is good, because you see a lot of not many anymore, but you still see scandals, right? And you can maybe even better project future scenarios with AI. So it will raise the level of confidence, of trust in the capital market. So I think, at least for auditing and consulting, yes, it will change the way we work. And yes, we have to change as well, as every other company has to as well. But the outcome will significantly increase, which is good for all of us.
Mm. You know, it makes me sometimes ask the question, you know, I have the feeling like it was even with the invention of the internet, you know, Wikipedia, these were great things. The data commons movement, I mean, I was a part of it back in the early 2000s, you know, this was a positive advancement in the ability for all humans to access knowledge. And I feel like sometimes now with AI, we've brought it to another level, and it's not only knowledge that's free, but intelligence is basically free. Mm-hmm. And this is this very fine line between what is uniquely human that we need to protect. If you were saying that many of the processes, you know, all the things you've been describing with audit processing, with, you know, with service centers talking to each other through their different GPTs, this is getting towards a point where you're melting those two Correct. Different realities. What should we protect? What is human that we need to make sure we don't replace with artificial intelligence or robots? Or how do we go forward in that path?
Well, it's difficult to project 100% future, right? But I think trust is something very deeply human. And as long there will be, well, it's probably best already there. We don't, or at least I don't totally understand artificial intelligence models, right? So I, to some extent, trust that my people who built it and who think, okay, you can trust our own AI, that they are right. But I feel significantly more confident if somebody else tells me, yes, it's right. So this personal trust, and there's still the same mechanism than 2000 years ago. You trust a person when you know him. And this will probably take weeks, months, years, whatever. So experience you gather together. And I think this is something you can't change. And what I more think about at the moment is, and this is probably if you as a human are in a industrial revolution, which we are in now, it's very difficult to project. But what happens to all the people the work is replaced by AI? I think in 50 years from now, and 30 years or 20 years from now, we will look back and say, okay, there was an industrial revolution. Yes, for 5, 6, 7 years, people lost their job, but we found new ways. We found new products. We found new ways they can work in. So it has, if you look back in history, there has always been an increase of wealth, always in the last 500 years of wealth, of humidity, of healthcare, longevity, whatever. Every number you can, every KPI you can take, it always went up. Also with technology. And I think that as long as we focus more on what we as humans can, and this is one-to-one interaction, there's an opportunity.
You know, I guess looking back, I like that analogy. I mean, it goes back from the beginning of time. You know, if you look at humans inventing the animal-drawn plow so that when they could do mechanized farming, that their productivity increased. When we invented steam factories in the, in the early Renaissance, there was, at the time though, there was huge revolution because the people, there was the frame breaking movements. There were the, what do they call them? The Luddites in England that were smashing up the factories because they said, this is taking our jobs. It's destroying our future. They didn't work, manual labor in factories anymore. They became the artisans, and the beginning of the large metropolitan areas like London and Manchester were born. So, I like this. Mm-hmm. This is a nice analogy. I guess, are there going to be, this trust, is it transferable? Because, you and me, we sit down and we drink a coffee. Mm-hmm. We send lots of subtle signals to each other that we have similar values, that we believe in similar things, that if I give you my word that I'm not going to walk away and stab you in the back metaphorically, these are all things that come from a whole lot of embedded cultural experience. Mm-hmm. Is that something that AI will develop? We talk about physical AI, embedded systems.
I don't think so. I think to a certain extent you would. You trust your car, right? If you put on my car, a Volvo, has this, autonomous driving, whatever stage it is, I don't know. So at least I trust this car, right? Yeah. So I trust that they can brake and accelerate and so on and so forth. So of course I trust it, but do I love my car? Well, I don't know. I love my wife and my kids and my friends, but I have a, And they are more emotional cars than Volvos, of course. But no, I think you can trust the process. I mean, that is probably the right description for AI. I trust the process. Mm. I trust that the outcome which I want to have is okay. Mm. But when you do business, yes, you can just focus on a technical outcome, but it makes more fun to work with people you like. Mm. So, and this is maybe a significant differentiator in the future. If the basis of technology is the same, if everybody uses AI, the outcome is very similar. But the difference, look at all the big, if all the big OEMs, if you buy a Mercedes, if you buy a BMW, if you buy an Audi, you're probably buying a great car. But what car you buy is probably which one you like, right? And although they are all the same, not 100% technically, but baseline is there's very good cars. So I think the differentiating factor is the human and all the emotions that comes with it. So I don't think that at some point of time you will love an AI. I don't think so.
You know, how does that relate back to your job? Because you said something fascinating to me in your first sentence. You said, when I'm not sleeping in a hotel, which means you're constantly traveling.
Correct.
And that means people don't want to have you just on a screen.
Exactly. So I'm traveling over 200 days a year. Yeah. So I'm an expert in hotel rooms, probably. And the differentiating factor after COVID, and we all thought in COVID, okay, all these one-to-one meetings, they're all gone. Because we were used to work on screen, in Teams meetings, face-to-face over 2 years or even more. But it took a couple of months, but it's back, and it's even the wish to know each other personally, not just on screen, has increased significantly.
Yeah. I'll say one more thing about it before I think we'll go into some more specific mm-hmm. cases around the work you're doing. And that's, I think, firstly, just to say that I underline 100% what you're saying about physical interaction. I mean, of course, I put my hand up and say I work in the events industry. I'm going to believe it that bringing people physically together in a room, it can be powerful. You know, these things, and if you look throughout history, you know, when things get tough, we come together. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter in what societies, we come together and we talk about how we overcome challenges. So I think that this aspect of embodiment, of being in a room, and it's also about the physical experience. You know, if you meet me at tech in a couple mm-hmm. of days' time, we will shake hands. Mm-hmm. And that's skin on skin. That's visceral. It's a human connection. And I think we should remember that doesn't get replaced in all of this. And now, look, I'm going to now pivot to talk more about, you know, I want to get insights into what you discover in the work you do. For our listeners, I mean, many of them are Mittelständler. They've been working on digitization. They've been getting on board with, you know, connected systems in their factories and IoT. What do they need to get right to really get started and make sure they get EBIT from their AI investments? You know, if they're working, wanting to modernize their processes.
I mean, number one is realize that every industry is in danger, mm-hmm. right? There's no single industry, maybe between hospitality or of VIPs, where still this kind of work will be changed by AI, right? But number one is, and realize you have to do it now. Number two is, and that is an advantage, by the way, of Mittelstand, because they can decide easily. They can decide immediately because they are the owners. They can decide and they have done it. So I'm not that negative on German Mittelstand as a lot of people are, because we have survived in Germany over a couple of hundred years. And I'm sitting in a board of a big, let's say, mid-sized international company owned by a family nearly 180 years. And they have started this journey 6 years ago and they just decided. So that is a brilliant example how you really can be better than the market. That's number. So number one is realize. Number two is decide. Number three is do it correctly. So don't take it as a hobby. Think about governance. And that is, from my observation, one of the, I'm not saying biggest mistakes, but one of the most underrated things. You need a governance for AI, right? So how do you use it? Where? For everything, ? Or just for specific processes? Can we use 5 different AI sources, or maybe just one? Should we? So there are so many questions. They can all be solved. That's not an issue. But do not think just because you buy ChatGPT, you're not an AI company. You need to change your whole operating system at the end of the day. And I still believe that the one who, or the companies, not it's not just one, but the companies who now try to do that very quickly will be the winners, because it's a massive game for speed. And at the end of the day, it's responsible AI, right? So make sure that it's responsible. And so there are a lot of opportunities for, especially for middle market companies who can decide quickly.
You know, this thing about the competitive advantage, you know, if you as a manager are more effective at your job, you make your company more effective. It spreads out, you know, into the macro where you look at the whole company. But there's also complexity. Do you go into companies and do these kind of huge process analyses of looking at where the touch points are? It's almost like an AI health check before people get started, or how do you approach it from the outside?
Well, that's not an easy question. I think first and foremost, you have to acknowledge that you probably already have started, because your employees who probably already use AI and you don't know, right? Because they have their iPhone, they have their whatever. So they already ask AI in their daily business life without any permission of your company. So I can just explain what we did. So at some point of time, we just stopped that. So you're not, at that point of time, you're not able to reach some AI sources from an EY computer, because we said, okay, we have to pull it through one single or two things, two AIs whatsoever, because we can't control. Mm-hmm. And then you can, of course, say, okay, which processes are easy to use first? I'll give you an example. There are very standardized processes like invoices coming in, right? Using AI for your invoice processment is a 4 weeks project.
No-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. Yeah. Just do it,
yeah.
Right? And then it also comes to a cultural shift, because if people see that it works, they get positive, right? So my first thing is do the very, very low-hanging fruits. Do them right. Involve a lot of people who see the benefits, and also show them that if you, for example, this invoice process, you don't fire the other ones. You just use them for smarter tasks. And then you get, because we're still humans, we all have our fears. We all want to develop. So use these examples and think a little bit about a couple of days before you start such a project. But then I think you get a very positive sentiment, because people see that they can use their daily work for smarter things than just reading invoices.
And I guess, is it something that you've seen as well, where you go into a company and you recognize an anti-AI culture, that people are already there and there's a real kind of a barrier to getting on board with it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they would call it anti-AI, but yes. I mean, that is human, right? And that's especially people who worked in an industry for a very long time, get a little bit old. I mean, that is human. They don't want to change. You know, if you see your retirement in 4 years, do you want to change? Do you want to invest? I don't know. Not everyone. Of course, number two is, I always see that in companies that are earning a lot of money right now. So the call for action is very limited if your company is earning a lot of money, because everyone says, well, why do we want to change? And looking back the last 5 years, our world has changed dramatically. Look, we have seen two wars. We have seen COVID. We still see presidents we never thought that could happen in one of the oldest democracies in the world. And people are just tired, right? They are just tired. So, of course, they would first inform, the first thing is stop. If you ask a 19-year-old person, he would say, yes, of course. But if you ask a 59-year-old person, he would say, or she would say, wait a minute, it worked well, it still works, and it will still work for 2 or 3 days, still I'm retired. So it's in every change process the same. Doesn't matter if it's AI or anything else.
Yeah, sometimes I guess this is something I wonder too, because, you know, I come from Australia. It's a different culture. And in Australia, you know, you can do things in companies that you just can't do in Germany, you know, because you have so many.
What, for example?
I mean, you know, even I just mean the example of putting in an AI system like, you know, Lundoc in a company. And if you want to do it, you have to go through a whole lot of processes in Germany through the Werks Council and, you know, Betriebsrat, you know, all these kind of things make this kind of these innovation steps challenging. Now, of course, there's a positive side. We want the protection of, you know, the rights of workers and all these kind of things. But culturally, I think in Europe, you put your finger on the pulse just before. You said, in the last 5 years, the game, you know, the whole situation has changed globally. The geopolitical situation is completely different. You know, we have a real imperative now, and if we don't get it right, we will suffer.
Good, but that's yes, and you're right. There are countries where change is more supported. And if you look to the eastern part of Europe, we already have countries where companies can be found in a day, right? And I think, especially in the European Union, there has to be a lot of change right now. But again, if you look back, we live in a very stable environment, right? So investors know what they get if they invest in Germany or if they invest in Europe. And this is, in uncertain times, an asset. But it also means that we have to change as a society as well. And one more thing, and I think that the AI revolution will also have a massive effect on our society in a whole. And I'm honestly, for example, I love to pay taxes in Germany. And you know why? Because it's safe. And I don't want to save 5% of my taxes to live in a country where we have social violence. I don't want to have this. So it's a massive asset to have all these checks and balances. But of course, it all comes to a certain extent.
you know, as it, in a way, what you're saying now also comes back to something you said at the beginning, which is about trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's trust in institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be taken for granted, you know, if you're living in a country where, you know, you can say we live in a completely free market and we can do things easily and quickly, versus knowing that there are systems and checks in place to make sure that the system isn't going to implode, that we won't end up with autocratic leaders. Mm-hmm. And I guess linking this in not just Germany, but talking about Europe, how do we now pivot to being competitive, knowing that we have these constraints and that they're sometimes very healthy? How can we sell Europe, or what does Europe need to do to be competitive on the global stage, you know, with all the major AI platforms now coming from the US or Canada, you know, just to putting it into kind of context? What can we now pivot in Europe to make sure that we stay relevant?
I think the easiest, I'm not saying it's easy, but the most, from my point of view, the most important thing that can be, and that can be achieved, right? I mean, we can talk about we need more Elon Musks or something. That's not, mm-hmm. not Elon itself, but, you know, all these entrepreneurs. I don't think we lack them. What I think Europe needs to understand that we need Europe as one single market. We still have tariffs between the countries, right? So if we just bring down all these tariffs and all this bullshit in a country, in one market, we would significantly outperform the growth of Asia or the US. But we're still negotiating in the European Parliament, because in France, we have a lot of farmers we don't have in Germany anymore. So it's very nationalistic. So if we really want to succeed politically, and then also from a society point of view, we need to make sure that Europe becomes one Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean we have to become one national Europe, but we just have to cut down all the tariffs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that everywhere in Europe we have the same legal entity structure. We have the same taxation. That doesn't make a difference if you set up your company in France or in Germany or in Portugal and wherever. That would significantly boost our economy. And that's relatively easy, because what we do have a history of a very, very strong industrial basis, right? So I'm very positive on industrial AI, because we do have all these production companies. Mm. The others don't. So it's not too bad, right? We just have to speed up. And we know from history that it always took, especially in Germany, a little bit longer to move. But when we move, we are pretty successful. Look at the industry, the weapon industry. We are now, I think, number three, and number two or number three in the world. So yes, it took Germany a little bit to understand that defense becomes important. But in the moment we understood that, industry is exploding. And that's, I think that's a very positive sign, beside that it's defense. But from an industrial point of view, I'm very optimistic.
Well, you know, I think on that point, you know, that goes back to a legacy of industrial history.
Correct.
And I think that this recreates itself. And I think you talked about investment, about let's pay our taxes, you know. Europe and Germany have a world-class education system, and this all feeds back in, you know. I think that, you know, on this podcast, we've said over and over again, we need to get better at commercializing. It's too mm-hmm. often that great IP that we invent here in Europe ends up being commercialized in the US or somewhere else. But at the same time, I think that we need to pivot with that advantage as well. And I think also that I like the idea of one Europe. I will say that our motto at Tech is, we believe in Europe, do you? And, you know, we'll be playing that throughout the Tech next week, talking about what we can do in Europe, how we can work together, collaborate within Europe, but also collaborate outside of Europe mm-hmm. as well, because it's not just, it's not about us versus the rest of the world, but it's us and the rest of the world. And look, before we close, it's been fascinating talking to you, but I'd love to get your insights into where you see it going. What's your vision? Where would you like to see yourself working with AI in 5 years' time, your company, and where would you like to see the whole journey going?
Good question. First and foremost, I think EY is a company as everyone else. So we are 12,000 people in Germany. So of course, I would love to see EY grow. And I'm pretty confident that in 5 years' time, we have been growing such because all these transformation projects needs to be guided and so on and so forth. So it's not just about us. It's there will be a lot of opportunities for consulting companies, and especially on audit, which I represent. We have just launched a new approach called Future of Audit Now. We have a lot of alliances with other companies like Microsoft, so, for example, or NVIDIA. So I'm very optimistic on that point of, because it's, you know, change will always mean you need people who guide, who give advice. So that's very positive. On a broader note, the things we just talked about, right? This legacy, this industrial basis. So I would love to see Germany leverage on it, right? That we, and I just took part in the Startup Award last Thursday in Berlin, and our chancellor, Mr. Merz, was there, and Verena Pauster did a great speech. And so the bottom line was, stop complaining, right? So just do it. Just do it. Do what everyone has done in Germany, or not everyone, a lot of people have done in Germany 50 years ago, 100 years ago. So we do have the legacy. We do have the ideas. Stop complaining, just do it. And if we do that, I'm very optimistic in 5 years' time that we are, this third time, coming from a weak man of Europe, right? You remember the cover, to the strongest. And we are still the strongest, but just from perception, being the growth driver, let's put it that way, I would love to see Germany being the growth driver of Europe.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Jan Brohilke, Managing Partner Assurance, EY Germany. We look forward very much to hearing from you into the future.
Dan, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.